Welcome to the Ivy Podcast. We're just two aunties sharing our experience through the lens of one Blackfoot woman and one Anishinaabe woman. And we are Indigenous Vision, an educational nonprofit based in Montana and Arizona. We are 100% Indigenous led, and this is our podcast. Check us out at indigenousvision.org to learn more about our work, make a donation, or play back any of our radio shows and this episode.
Hey there. Before we get to this podcast, I just need to warn you that we are going to be discussing subjects that will be very sensitive and could bring up a lot for you or anyone who might be listening in the room with you. So here is your official trigger warning for suicide, the conversation we'll be having today on the Indigenous Vision Podcast, episode 80. Thank you.
Hello and welcome to the Indigenous Vision Podcast. We are officially on episode 80. My name is Melissa Spence. I am with Suta Collinglast, who, if you didn't know, is our executive director, and she's also the co-host. And we have a very special episode. We have a very special guest as well to kind of talk about, I guess we'll just say the winter blues, or just blues in general is how I'm going to word it. But maybe you can introduce yourself, Terrence, and kind of give us a rundown on who you are, what you do, and how you impact the community that you're a part of.
Hello, friends and relatives. I'm so excited just to be in your guys' space. I had visited Suta a while back, and my name is Terrence LaFromboise. I come from the Blackfeet Reservation, and currently residing on the Blackfeet Reservation while working remotely for the state, the Department of Public Health and Human Services. And the work that I do is under the Behavior Health Disabilities Division, which used to be Addiction, Mental Health and Disabilities Division, AMDD. And the switch has kind of come over just with the new change in governance. Prior to this post, I used to work on the ground, boots on the ground on the Blackfeet Reservation. I created and helped mold the Silent Warriors Coalition, which was a community coalition that looked at creating space for addiction and domestic violence and homelessness, that look at combating the silence we see on reservations. And it's rampant within those different areas, and really creating a space to be loud. So we had this coalition created, and we started our 501c3, which later transferred into more work with community organizations. I then created the Bikuni Youth Council, which has started back in 2017. And since then, just because of, I think, my vision of it, it's been kind of in a standstill with very too little youth being participating, even though there's so much that youth need to be advocated for, so much youth spaces that need to be created. And that's been my goal, and to really create a space that's going to be sustainable and not be some sort of another tribal politic trick, I guess you would say, that is going to just kind of run dry of its grant supply or money. I'm really trying to create a sustainability for some of the youth councils, because to have a youth council directly correlated with the tribe is something that I think we're all wanting. And kind of leads me into, I think, the topic of today and the work I do today with Department of Public Health and Human Services is suicide. And really what that all entails, especially coming into these long winter months, and how nationally, a while back, there was a research done by a company that looked at, and I think it was a flying, an airline company, that looked at the most depressing day of the year, which I believe is coming up here pretty soon on January 16th. And what does that mean? Well, the idea is there is this kind of halfway point between, you know, coming into winter and then that extension of winter, especially where we're from in these higher elevation areas. So it seems to say that vitamin D, in my line of research, has been known to cause depression. So if you link those two together, especially in our states such as Washington, Idaho, North and South Dakota, there's kind of like a suicide belt, if you will, of states that have the highest amount of suicides nationally. And those statistics come from middle-aged white men. They come from veterans, and then they come from the Native American population. Those three specific areas rank the highest among suicide completions. and suicidalities linking to depression. And that's where we see in our systems of care is really using screening tools that could really guide communities and organizations to create an accurate assessment. And that's the type of work that I do with tribal relations, and I work with specific tribal contracts. And I think it's very important to say that Zero Suicides has been implemented for the past 4 or 5 years. We're coming on year 5 of the grant, and it's been a very unique experience. Like I said, I was boots on the ground in my community working with this grant while also running Methamphetamine Suicide Prevention Initiative, which was a federal grant. And all these linked me directly to specific areas within my community, whether it was working with youth, whether it was directly linked to healthcare systems of care, our first responders, and then also IHS, and then pretty much in every aspect, because you could look at the winter blues, depression, suicide, in a space where as humans, there's this stigma that we have placed on mental health. And the work that I think we do in decolonization and really creating a space to create Indigenous modalities and tools that is going to connect with, you know, the people we serve, that has to kind of come into alignment with so many different areas, because suicide is so vast. We could work on homelessness and we could be hitting it, but we still be missing it way off. We could work on youth and engagement and support, but we'd still be hitting it way off, because the system itself has created so many different areas that it's really hard to combat and support somebody who's going through mental health illnesses and health issues, and learning the difference between those and recognizing that we all suffer from different aspects of mental health, and to really create a space where we destigmatize that so we can have conversations. Because what we recognize in our systems of care is the employees can't even create a space for themselves. How are they going to create a space for the people they serve and the clients that they're there to support? So the work that I do specifically around Zero Suicides, which is a federal grant, looks at creating a competent workforce, looks at creating sustainability within an organization, and creating a more so a pathway. You're going to hear my baby cry a little bit, but I'm a new father and I'm so excited. And that's why I've been kind of hitting off. But Zero Suicides is that step-by-step model that a lot of reservations, tribal health systems, and urban centers never had a clear pathway. And a lot of them are taken from different westernized tools, again, that don't hit with our native populations, our urban natives and our reservation natives. And when we look at those statistics and we can create a space such as Zero Suicides to have such a vast goals and implementations to then hit on certain spaces, but to really make them unique to the community. And that's been missing for the past 4 years. And, you know, you guys know as well as I do, coming out of a pandemic, talking about some of those statistics nationally within, you know, the United States, specific to Native Americans, the trajectory for, forgive me as I continue to look into my data brain, one of the things that I remember seeing within the data is since 2010 to 2020, we've had a steady stream of around 23 suicides per year, almost in this specific area in this time frame too. But in that conscious thought, coming into 2020, coming into 2021, and then coming into 2022, the data showed us in 2021 that had jumped to 43 suicides. So we were averaging a little below 23. Now we jumped up to 43 just in 1 year. And the pandemic showed us how insufficient and how inadequate our systems of care really are. When we had lapses of government communication, we had lapses in real time system support and also employee support on a tribal, state, and federal level. And we are ward still, and we still continue, some of tribes in Montana continue to look at sovereignty. So there's a lot of lingo called 638, which looks at creating a state reservation sovereignty. So there is this sometimes clear connection to support and sometimes not so clear, depending on your type of sovereignty. So there is a lot of nuances, I think, working within reserves and reservations. And I think one thing I forgot to talk about, and I think that has led me down this path and has created spaces for me, for spaces for others, is I just recently graduated from my graduate program at the University of Toronto, the Factor Inuitesh School of Social Work, which was a new program called MSW Indigenous Traumas and Resiliency, created by the OFICI, which is some office of federation in Ontario. And then there is Jane Middleton Moe's Institute, and Jane Middleton Moe's does a lot of work throughout Canada and the United States on reserves on trauma. And she's a big part of the TRC report. So she's my teacher and mentor. I work a lot with her up in BC area, Port Alberni. And we do a lot of trauma work for trauma survivors, residential school survivors. So I'm really trying to link what Canada's doing to what we need to be doing in Montana. I've said this time, and as I've been in the program in Canada, it feels like the Canadian government to Indigenous relationships is obviously and bad, but it seems that they have been a little more efficient in terms of recognizing some of the atrocities, where in the United States that has just now started to happen with Deb Haaland. So recognizing where I always felt like some Indigenous pathways and modalities that are connected to social work or public health systems are like a little further in Canada. One of my mentors, Reggie Croshu from Alberta, does a lot of work with the healthcare systems. And he created this thing called, well, it's not created, it's something we did as Piikani people, Tsitsigaytsitipi, which is called Agatsiman, which is decision-making and mediating. So it's a mindset. And he took that teaching and he put it into a healthcare model. And that's what the program had taught me at the University of Toronto, is to take westernized tools and modalities to put a cultural context or to create a cultural component and then add tools. Because it's always been the flip-flop. It's like, oh, could you add culture? Like, you know, like some spices, like, you know, oh, no, we're not spices. We're not none of that. You know, we need to be the foundation. And those cultural tools will lead us to some of these spaces that are different from where we're leading to now. Mm-hmm. And I'm sorry, I just went off. I just started talking. I didn't even get a chance to give you a breath. So I'll stop now.
No, but you brought up a lot of important points. And like, you know, this part, this time of the year, it's really dark. Like you see outside my window and it's gray. And I live in Missoula, Montana. And that's where a lot of Blackfeet are and Blackfoot people are. And it's kind of in this geography and region have a lot to do with it. It's kind of in this bowl and there's an inversion and pressure layer, which keeps clouds kind of like hovering over us. So the rest of Montana can have a sunny blue day and we can have like a gray day. So I want to back up and you said you want vitamin D helps prevent depression?
Yes.
Okay, so, good. I've taken vitamin D.
I guess, you know, the research supports, and the research is coming out of University of Utah and the University of Colorado that looks at, there's a link to elevation. So you recognize, and in the state of Montana, some of the higher places of suicide do stem in the higher elevations. But then you're thinking, well, there is some lower elevations where reservations are on and they have high rates of suicide. So so a lot of what we recognize in research is a cause and effect, a correlation. And I think recognizing that, but vitamin D, and we recognize, like I just came from Browning and I've traveled over to Whitefish and it's gloomy, snowy over here. Browning, it was just nice and sunny, little breeze, you know, you kind of had to lean into it a little bit, but you recognize what you just said is sometimes we don't get enough, and especially we have long winters. So you got Alaska, Montana, Washington, Oregon, Idaho, all with high rates of suicide. They have a long winter months. So there are correlations to specific research. And this is one thing we don't have too in Indian country is specific data that could support some of the things that we're asking. Like on a national level, we could type in specifics around teenagers and guns, and they could create a list that could show us in real time of the data. We don't have that data on the reservations. And I know there's a lot of organizations that create those data, but then again, what we lack is direct communication to these specific organizations. And what we call them is silos. And we're deep in those silos where we're not able to get out. Sometimes the grant does that, where my goals and objectives don't connect with yours. And yeah, I'm going off topic here because we were talking about vitamin D there for a second.
That's okay. It's like a tough subject because there's so many parts of the problem and the issue. And one of the things that we've been working on here is, like, as women of color and Indigenous women, the cumulative effect of, like, just the little tiny daily stressors of our life, like going to the grocery store or going to the doctor, and then the treatments that we find there, and how those are not so bad in the instance. But when you think about a lifetime of mistreatment or injustices, that's when you start to get more grief stricken and depressed. And then I have had several friends who have taken their lives before we were even 25, a few of them in high school. And a couple reached out to me, but I wasn't able to get to them in time. And so you think about the ripple effects of just that. I'm just one person, but this must be happening several times over. And I have extreme amount of survivor's guilt of not being able to answer that phone call or not being able to drive there fast enough. So it just always concerns me. Like, now when I have a sad friend, I'll, like, put extra attention and love to them just to make sure that they don't, you know, just letting them know, like, just give me the amount of time to drive there and I'll drive you and I'll take you for a cruise. We'll do something, get your mind off of it. And because everything's temporary, right? Everything we go through as humans is a temporary condition. And that's a very final decision we're making. And I think when we step back and we look at our problems as individuals, and even, like, environmental conditions that may be factoring into that. So, like, our community has been hit really hard with a lot of deaths. There's a lot of elder deaths. There's a lot of youth deaths. Some communities, First Nation communities, are experiencing youth suicide packs. So we'll have, like, 8 to 12-year-olds, a dozen at a time, taking their lives. So there's some really unprecedented events happening across Native American and First Nation communities. And Saskatchewan just came out with a quantitative study from 2000 to 2020. And we like to focus on people here because I like the balance of men and women. So we tend to get funded for a lot of Indigenous women things, but then I'm an advocate of that we can't be fully healthy Indigenous women unless we have healthy men in our community as well. Like, we can't have one side healthy and protected and resourced without the other side. So yes, that balance, we need it. But they found that teenage and status First Nation females age 15 to 25 had the highest rates of hospitalization for self-harm. Their rates were higher than other, and this is Saskatchewan specifically, their rates were higher than other First Nation females and males. So Saskatchewan is having, and it's very flat there, right? Like, at least us Blackfeet, we can escape to our mountains, right?
Right.
The rates of hospitalization for self-harm were significantly higher for First Nation people than everyone else. And on average, rates were more than 7 times higher for First Nation females and 4 times higher for First Nation males. And I've experienced in just these last couple of months, 2 youth who were under the age of 18 who needed someplace to go were experiencing feelings of self-harm and suicide, and they had to wait for hospitalization. This same thing you're talking about, like,
yeah, everything you had hit on, Suta, especially being that Saskatchewan, Montana, Alberta, right? You hit it on the head. The line is this made up line that separates us, but the data could be kind of go both ways. When we recognize on a national level, I've seen is if it's one way on the national level, it might be flip-flop where males have a high rate of suicide on a national level. And then on the reservations, it might be females, urban natives. So that kind of data, right, is we need to get those points. You also hit on a point with the environment. And I think the work that you do, Suta, is especially creating that sense of belonging that is really needed for not only us as humans, but us as Amskapi, Pikani, Pikani, Sitigate, Sitipi, and our neighboring tribes, all of them, as we connected to them through trade, through marriage, through time and memorial, environment plays a huge key to some of the aspects that we're seeing today. So you look at Saskatchewan, you know, to me, I've recognized we can call specific areas in Alberta, Montana, you know, we can call them the deep north. You know, there's so much, I think, heavily systemic racism and just blatant racism. It causes some of the depression that we see. And when you're trying to just live a life where you're constantly seeing, whether it's, I don't know the word, but it's like, not like indirect, like it's not direct, but it's kind of like that indirect racism where you don't really recognize it, but you're feeling it. That over time.
Microaggressions.
Right. So, and we see those in specific areas. And I hate to say, I felt like I was blind to a little bit, but I'm seeing it more and more. The more I attune myself to my neighbors, because I think mine has been in my own grief. Just like you, Suta, I have experienced heavy loss with suicide. In the past 5 years, I've lost 5 people. In just 1 year, though, we've lost 3. So it kind of just evens out. So heavy that our family doesn't have time to heal. And a lot of it is around specific. So you hit on a big head that I think a lot of people and family members are suffering with, is that survivor's guilt. And what could I have done? And what should I have done? And they're tools for this, because a lot of this and what we know, and I want to say this, is it's not our fault as survivors. And we can still create a memory and space for our loved ones that is positive. Because suicide has such a stigma around it, we have a hard time sometimes even saying the word. And it's in that concept that we need to get rid of. It's bringing it up, talking about it, will not bring up ideations. In fact, it could possibly save a life. The research says ask direct, relatable questions. Don't tippy-toe around specifics that if someone feels and had mentioned or had just jokingly said, I don't feel like being here, or had just started noticing specific behaviors around addiction or usage or abuse on themselves or others, those are red flags. And you can divvy those into different areas where, you know, sometimes we just struggle and we're going through these spaces and it's okay. But then when it gets to a space where we're hurting others or ourselves, then there is that time where we should be reaching out. But because of the shame attached to mental health and the insecurities we have in our own generational patterns lead into us not wanting to reach across that barrier, similar to the silos. You hit a very important point that healthy leadership or healthy, and we put in the context of leadership, parenting, all those need to be kind of promoted. And with that sense of attuning that to the land that sustains us. And then really getting back to that balance of the animals that create some of that sustainability, and to go forward where, again, we have lost so much as generations passed. That means that we can then gain if we have lost. So there is this mindset, I think, as Indigenous people, we have in us the strength, this empowerment that is connected to our ancestors, to the land that sustains us, but we're caught up in these generational westernized habits like addiction, like grief, because we had ways that we could help. And grief has been there, but it has really intertwined with some of the direct technology that has then is what we're doing today. You know, could be some of the hindrances and disconnections we see according to some of those elders. But yeah, Suta, you hit it on the head that those correlations and linkages all start and stem from specific spaces. And if we can get to those spaces and start to educate awareness and intervene and create postvention and interventions and preventions, we can start to see that change. And winter blues, again, is that concept made up by a westernized thought that they were like, well, what's the most depressing day? And obviously you're going to pick the day that's halfway between spring and the end of summer, because fall And then the spring, that's, if you look at it, it's almost dead center in terms of numbers. So again, Gregorian calendar, we're living in this mindset that's westernized. How do we attune to get out of that while still holding integrity to, you know, the 22nd century, whatever. So I think there's so much I think we could really dive into. I don't want to take up any more of your time, but man, I could really talk and talk and I think
Sometimes we have whole hour episodes and this is really important because this is an episode that could potentially save a life.
Yeah.
Letting people know that they are not alone in how they're feeling and that there's probably lots of people out there feeling just the same way. And there is just as many people wanting to be there for you and willing to drive and willing to talk on the phone with you. And that's what we try to, you know, I guess I'm trying to be in my change management courses for my master's degree, I learned about preventative management and crisis management. And we're living in a society, the colonial framework is all crisis management. It has that mentality of do it and then ask for forgiveness later, mm-hmm. instead of creating those mutually beneficial relationships first. Taking care of the environment as a baseline foundation of taking care of the people is one way that we hope to take care of culture and preserving the culture. Because I feel like if we don't have access as people to healthy environments and landscapes, then we are lacking a big part of our healing mechanisms. Historically, wintertime necessarily wasn't the most depressing time of the year, unless you didn't listen to the animals and the seasonal signs and you put your camp in the wrong place and you didn't have a successful winter hunting. But if you paid attention to your environment and you knew where to put your camp and you knew that the river would be flowing year round, you even had some hot springs nearby and you knew the animals would be there, winter was not a depressing time and you would spend time working on your crafts, making your new outfits, telling stories, sitting around the campfire and hearing all of those origin stories all over again. We don't have that anymore because we have so much adopted internal colonial violence that we've projected towards each other. So like, how hard is it for us to like have regular weekly all night smokes and prayers and story sessions throughout the winter time that youth don't feel that they need a special invitation to? Even adults and community members, adults our age, feel like we need a special invitation to a ceremony, where in the past you had the camp crier say, so-and-so is going to have this event, everybody's welcome, show up. Now it's a little different in that people are like, I don't want to go unless I have an invitation.
And are they eating? You know, are they got the food? I'm not going to go, man. I'm going to make 10 kids. One thing that kind of caught me was that colonial, that construct we live in, right? It really does hinder our connections to each other and the land. And I like that. I've heard that a couple other times. And it's a good reminder that, you know, what we do practice is crisis. You know, we're always in this crisis. We don't necessarily create spaces to, once we're in those crises, to help us out of it. One thing that I'd learned in my master's program was a wellness plan. And prior to the social work program, I had graduated from the University of Montana from the social work bachelor's program. And it was awesome. I was like, man, I'm a native. I am out here doing it. And I'm going to go back to my community like I said I was going to. Well, I was a 2+2 program because BCC has a really nice engagement where you can stay in your community and go to college. That's what I was in. And it was just awesome. And then I got into the master's and it was like, heal yourself so you can help others. Mm-hmm. And then that healing process was so hard. It was so hard. It opened up spaces within me that I think now I'm a fine tuning, but it is that I think it's guiding me to these specific spaces. Because in my experience within that modality of healing myself is I've been very critical now of others and I need to get it out of that space because that criticalness could create toxic for others. So I've been learning to allow myself to feel, whereas men, you talked about it earlier, that toxic masculinity, that there's a lot of narcissistic values passed down generationally to men. And it's going to take healthy men to really create that balance, to really stand up with women strong women, healthy women. And there's got to be that reciprocity. And that's what we know as Omskapi Pikani, as Pikani people, that we recognize that balance, how we ran ceremony, how everything was in a position, and how we can take that mindset and engage it and incorporate it in today's society. Like you mentioned, going into these spaces that is going to create access for youth and give elders a place. And I think, oh, this is where I was getting to. It was the winter time. You're right. We never had these experiences until westernized society, colonialism had kind of creeped its way in. And one of the things I'm thinking about now is the snow is falling, is our Napi stories in Salish culture, coyote stories. Those sustained us, those supported us, those holy smokes throughout winter, many different types of society gatherings. And then just recently, I think this is where my head was going, was as I go and see other men and work with men, I ask questions, you know, and they always bring up, oh yeah, you youngins don't even know. We'd have the old round hall out in Star School, have the old round hall out in Heart Butte. You know, we don't do that no more. Nobody does that. And I'm like, why? Why don't we do that? Mm-hmm. And a lot of that is, you know, I could say that, but then I'm so impacted by trying to live in a way that's going to make me successful and my family, continue to create generation success. And that's the thing, is westernized thought has to be in a way that is in this process where indigenous thinking is in a community sense. So in my own walk, I get confused because sometimes I'm like, I am an individual living in this community, but then I am a community member and I have a duty, but we don't, a lot of people don't have that civic engagement anymore. Even in a westernized generation has changed. And as I think I'm a millennial, generations below me have now started to kind of push back against the system. So what we recognize is what's happening on a Western level affects us in our daily lives who live on reserve, who are just going through the process, and we have to live in two worlds. That's another good thing to talk about is some of us are out of balance because we have to manage both worlds. That could cause a lot of disconnection to our sense of self. And I think a lot of indigenous youth talk about this. I don't connect to my language. I don't connect to my culture. Help me. And sometimes it's too late. You know, we've waited, and it's a two-part thing. You look at psychology, and there is a time in our adolescence and then in our childhood that are the most important parts of that learning engagement style. And anytime after that, you have a hard time conceptualizing and creating concrete subjects and ideas within your brain. And you think about the lack of education we have in specific reservations or reserves, or the lack of support and resources, and even continuing college or trades, how that could cause a lot of disconnections that we're seeing, and we are seeing those in real time. Oh, my boy.
No, that's so cute. You just have a brand new baby. And I love the circumcision conversation that you had on Facebook around it. Because I also didn't get my son circumcised either. So I left him whole. It's not my decision. It's his body.
Not to. I felt like I've learned so much as a father, and I've gained knowledge to that idea that it isn't our way of doing things, and educating was the best tool for me. But it took me not listening to even my generational family. They were like, you got to do it. It's because of these things. And I'm like, no, those are debunked now, which, you know, these can cause everyday little frustrations. What could cause some of these blues we feel during these winter months where we're disconnected with family, then we fight with family, and then we're like, it's not what we want to do, but because of the lifestyle we live, we're always that kind of headbutting, and it can cause some of this grief. So what I seen yesterday, and I put that out there, I found it so amazing because there was no arguing. There was no combating each other about their views and lifestyles. Everybody had an opinion. And it was validated. And that right there, I think, is what we need to do as a culture, even on Facebook, is validate people's voices. We're always quick to invalidate each other. in any space, whether you're LGBTQ, you are always invalidated in certain spaces systemically, or even just physically, emotionally, mentally, being Indigenous, same way. So you think about those things we go through and how it's up to us to break those down, but at the same time to really create spaces for awareness on those.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And so what I want to end with is it's kind of a private thing, but I know you'll understand and I know you'll have some ideas on it, being from the same nation and being a cultural practitioner. As much as you can. One of my Sweat Lodge conversations when I have, you know, Sweat Lodge conversations, they're pretty unique and they're really special. And, you know, you go through, they call a Sweat Lodge like a womb or a portal, you know, and you go through some extreme heat and steam, and it's a healing steam because it's got willows and some pines and it's just a really good environment to, and I regret because my baby is the first baby, like me and all my brothers and sisters have been sweat babies since we were in diapers. We grew up in there and we never had problems with heat. And now I'm like in, as an urban Missoula native, I always want to put up a sweat in my yard really quick. And like, just, can I just for my baby? Right. But one of the most important pivotal moments in my life that helped me get through some of the hardest times that I've ever had came from a Sweat Lodge conversation on death. And it was sorrowful in that we didn't have, excuse me, my baby's homesick. We didn't lose our loved ones. We lost their physical presence.
I want to chime in and my experiences, and I've heard from one of our council members who had really 180'd his life, and he talked about going to treatment so many times, and they finally had done some cultural stuff at the treatment center and they went and did a sweat. He said it was in that sweat that transitioned his mind to think differently. Something I think we probably all want in terms of supporting our loved ones who are struggling and failing in certain aspects, that's what we want. And was it the sweat? Was it his empowerment to want to shift? Was it the court cases, the drug cases, the prison time? What was it? Mm-hmm. And I believe that the specifics in his healing came from that sweat. Because then I asked him, well, what kind of sweat was it? He said, I don't know. And then you get to the person who put that sweat on. So you know that they come from specific medicine or our family teachings or songs. So you know there's specific songs that are out there to support areas in our lives that could give us strength, could give us food when we need it, could guide us, and it could change the weather. And as corny and as Indigenous as that sounds, these things are innate to us and we have them in our back pockets. And if we can go back and reach back there and connect with our past ancestors and our current ancestors and our elders and in ourselves, you know, create that balance. And that comes from the sweat, those teachings, the way the rocks burn hot and why they burn in a specific way, the way, whether you get a rattle or, some branches or a ladle, whether you have water from the creek or water from your, over time, it's been the practice, I think, of the song. And what we recognize as Omskapi, our Indigenous and different cultures, is the power of our language and the power of song. So you think about how important that is. And what we recognize in today's science, how science is catching up to a lot of how rhythm creates spaces within ourselves to balance, or how sound can now lift objects. And we knew these things because we see them. We've seen them over time. We've heard about them from our grandmothers and grandfathers saying, healing somebody without medical technology. Those things come and those are direct links to, I think, what we interpret in the sweat. And again, right, we all interpret these specific teachings differently. You know, what comes to women doesn't necessarily come to men. And we can say, oh, that's sexist, but that's just the way it was. And I think here's another concept when we look at two spirits, you know, they're, again, more powerful, more engaging. So their medicine is what we looked at as whoa. And that, I think this is where the disconnection we had, as the whoa in today's society is bad. To us, it was revered. It was like, you are powerful. Mm-hmm. And this is where we disconnect. And that's why I think, you know, with movements and other spaces, with the Me Too movement, you know, now there's going to be a time where men are going to have to step up and talk about, you know, their sexual abuse and the abuse that they have given to others. Mm-hmm. I think it's very important for us as men to do that. And you asked earlier, it's going to take healthy men. Well, what is it going to take to create healthy men? Because I know now, as a man, I still struggle with certain narcissistic things that I'm trying so hard in my life to not transfer to my sons, but at the same time, create space for myself to not hold on to those, that they're not a part of me, that they come from spaces that I've seen direct violence. And it gets me teared up, because I think in my path, I think my journey and where I've been going is to really help other men. And you hit it on the head. It's going to take that. So there's got to be a movement somewhere that looks at creating more healthy men and learning those cultural practices and values that are going to not only look at creating strong, healthy men, but getting rid of those Western egotistical, narcissistic things that are attached to the generational traumas we've seen. And it isn't just men. Women can carry these as well. And I think women are in that space to do the work that they're doing. That's why the Me Too movement was created, was that we're no longer going to stay silent. That, and it's the same kind of core concept that I truly believe, that in societies, we're silent on certain issues, that it creates so much trauma and stigma that we do push it to the side. We do not talk about our family secrets. We don't talk about those community secrets, when in reality, it's the opposite that needs to take place in order to heal. And until those spaces aren't done, we'll continue to kind of be in these patterns where it's just like, generationally, we're still struggling. Why? Why has it been since 2010, suicide's been so high? Why haven't we been able to, you know, why is Montana ranked number 3? And why are Alberta, Saskatchewan have the highest numbers in murdered and missing and suicide and domestic violence? You know, why? And I think this is an important thing that we need to let youth know, is it's up to them to ask those questions and to get those answers. Because eventually our generation is going to hopefully be in a space to create safety for those generations. And it's got to be kind of ever evolving. And that is an Indigenous concept, because Western society lives on a timeline. And what we know is everything comes full circle eventually. So we got to get to that concept where we're in a space and we're attuning ourselves to a more cultural sensitive way that's creating more inclusion for ourselves and our non-native allies. And I think that's another thing to add, is incorporating our non-native allies, because they struggle along with us. Their suicide rates are as high too. And that's the thing about per capita, is recognizing that even in our white culture, there's still so much suicide in that culture. How can we cross those barriers and create a space for all humans where we stop putting these quote unquote headlines, taglines on people, and we can just be human beings again. Sitsigay, Tsitsipi, Nitsitipi, real people. I think that's my overall goal. Sorry, I get a little choked up. I think it's a big part of who I am. I like to now show, as men, it's okay to be emotional, and it's okay, because what it's not okay is to be angry. And that's the difference, is carrying those emotions could turn into anger. Letting them go helps us process and see things differently. And I just wish this for my grandfathers and my uncles and my cousins out there. So to have a platform to be able to speak to somebody feels good. So I really appreciate that this opportunity.
Thank you for helping us break the silence on suicide, which I think is ultimately key. Thank you.
Yeah. And what we're figuring out more is that people the hardest thing for people to do is to talk about it. And we can't even talk about assumptions that we carry and that we've inherited from our family. And that's what we train in culture humility. And we do dialogue activities and exercises, and we can work with people for weeks on end, and there will still be uncomfortability in talking about your experiences. And once people do find the comfort and the safety to speak about their experiences, there's a lot of emotion that comes with that. And us as listeners have to just hold back all judgments and assumptions and just realize the cool part about culture humility was finding that compassion in our own journeys, but in other people's journeys, and that, holy cow, this might be the first time, you know, Terrence might've been able to speak about colonial toxic male issues compared to Blackfoot male issues. And I've always thought deep on, like, our men are in trouble because the colonial ego and pride system is so different from the pride and ego system in Indigenous communities, especially the Blackfoot community. And I grew up with, like, chief status and like baller status based on how much things you can give away. And I was one of those poor kids at the giveaway dance that they don't have anymore, going to get my supplies. Like, and I would be so happy to bring my mom home towels that some old lady danced for me to give. And I worry about kids, poor kids in our community, because we still live in a hugely depressive state of poverty, and where they're getting their supplies, and they don't have that opportunity, like going to the giveaway dance and filling up like all the stuff that they could possibly give away and dance, and then trading those items for stuff that they need or can use, or things that we never even thought that we needed. But our needs, our basic needs. So like sometimes grandmas were just dancing with deodorant and toothpaste in front of me, and I was thankful for it because it was like, what, $5 my mom didn't have to spend, and I brought it home. And so those opportunities, though, our community needs. And I appreciate the work that you're doing, Terrence, into bringing all those events out and even talking about the hard subjects when no one wants to talk about it. And I see you do that a lot. And today is one of those conversations. And so I hope everybody gets more comfortable with talking about the things that hurt and are hard to talk about, and know that there's somebody out there who's willing to listen to you.
Yes, there is. I want to say thank you. And I want to take your culture of humility class. I've seen it. I've created something. When I've seen your guys's, I've created the Indigenous Trauma-Informed Leadership. And it's very similar to creating just a safe space for leaders in our community. So I would love to connect with you guys more and to continue to work with you guys. I wanted to leave you with something that we've created, me and my friend Hungu Kane, who is a Korean, who actually lives in Northern Alberta up in Edmonton right now. And we created this at the University of Toronto for one of our classes. It was an assignment, but we actually got highlighted by the University of Toronto, and we're highlighted by some ABTN, some big news station up there that has kind of given us more space. And it kind of is giving me that definite path that I think men and myself is, there's this forgiveness. So I wanted just to kind of talk. So me and my friend Hungu Kane came into the program, and the program is very Indigenous minded. We were tasked to come up with a healing tool for a cultural component of a workshop. And we had decided to create a Korean teaching with having, I had just lost my grandmother to COVID. And we were just finishing up our first year in that master's program. And the assignment again was creating that value with a workshop. And we come up with Terugu, combining our both names, Terrence and Hungu. We called him Gu. And I want to say what it means. And Somon is little ripening, which is a Korean word of transitioning or healing. Terugu is a ceremonial chant, came about as a memory into forgiving the lineages before us and becoming an instant moment in passing that has lasted a lifetime and more. It's an honor to sing a song in spirit in the new beginning between the ashes of the war in Korea and the medicines of the Blackfeet that has crossed lives in many up to now. Somon, little ripening, has begun and are reminded of the things that bring us life and the energy that helps us move from spring into summer. a kind of metaphor for a new bond that we have forged through the forgiveness and memory of war, the pain, the story and resilience. Terugu is a brotherhood of bridging worlds, languages, and cultures into the same humanity that undertones our collective existence. It is in the new world imagination of what is possible and what is true, a new beginning of healing that is both ancestral and contemporary. We forged a new relationship through the stories of our people, and together we have embarked on this journey of ripening a new beginning. So we invite you to Terugu. And that is going to be our teaching, I think, to help men forgive not only their past selves, but to forgive their present selves. So I wanted to leave that out here in this space. So thank you so much, Sutta. Thank you so much for just allowing me to continue to, this gives me space to do the work that I do. It gives me recognition that things are being noticed, and we'll continue to put this out there in a good way.
Thank you so much for listening to the Indigenous Vision Podcast, episode 80, Breaking the Silence on Suicide. We hope you were inspired by this episode, whether it be for reaching out, being there for someone, or beginning or continuing your healing journey. Support is available by texting 988, the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline, and offers 24/7 call, text, and chat access to trained crisis counselors who can help people experiencing suicidal substance use and or a mental health crisis or any kind of emotional distress. We love you, and we love that you are here. Thank you so much for listening.